Well, good morning. It's good to be with you guys, and I hope y'all slept great. I slept really good for an hour until I found out that I was in the girls' room. And then I went from a secluded, awesome corner listening to a podcast after a fresh melatonin to going to another room on the top bunk under a light. Thanks, Ryan. Appreciate that one. I'm just kidding. But it really is good to be with you all. And Malvin, I love you, man. And I feel better now after that introduction as to many of the other directions you could have gone. They say that a lesson is something that you learn through either studies or experience. And I remember very vividly being in the middle of my studies, but also in the middle of an experience that a lot of you have gone through, and that is a youth internship. And about 2 weeks into that youth internship, the elders called me into a meeting, and they let me know that Ryan, who was the youth minister, was moving to Jacksonville, Florida to be a preacher. And so then they asked me, would you be interested in being the interim youth minister until we found somebody way more mature and responsible than you are? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And so I took advantage of that opportunity. And on a Sunday morning, the shepherds at university got up in front of everyone and said, Andrew's going to be the interim youth minister until we find the permanent person. And then Monday morning, the very next day, before my 8:30 class at Faulkner, I get a call from Phil Norton, one of the elders. And he let me know that Hannah, one of the little girls in our youth group, her dad had taken his life that morning, and that he wanted me to go to Hannah's house and to be with her. And I hopped in my 1987 Ford Bronco, headed to her house. And I'm sure when I talked to my elder and told him I would do that, I probably sounded pretty confident. Yeah, I got this, you know, I no problem at all. But on the inside, I was an absolute wreck, because I was going through all the things in my mind that I'd sat through in different courses on ministry, but I don't really remember something on how to handle a situation like this. And so I sat actually out in front of her house for a long time. It probably was longer in my mind than it really was. But as I was sitting there, I was thinking, all right, what am I going to say to help her? And there you can kind of see my problem. What am I going to say to fix this? And again, you can still continue to see my problem. And I was about to walk in, and what should have been my first resort was my last resort. Before I stepped out of that car, I decided, you know what, I'm going to pray. And God, will you give me the words that I need to say to Hannah? And so I prayed and I walked in that door. Instead of God giving the words to me that I needed to say, God did something way better. He shut my mouth. And so I walked into that room and I sat there with Hannah. She grabbed some board games, and for the next 4 hours, we played board games. I walked out that day, and as I was, her mom came up to me and she said, thank you for doing that for Hannah. That's exactly what she needed. Life has a way, doesn't it? Especially life in ministry, of teaching us lessons that we'll never forget. Fast forward from that time to my very first year in ministry, things were going well. Our ministry was growing, and we were starting to have a great impact on the campus at Faulkner. And while everything in our ministry was going great, things weren't going so well at my house. I had that kind of mentality early on in ministry that maybe a lot of you had, to where if there was anything going on, I felt like I needed to be there. If the college students called me at 10 o'clock at night and said, hey, we're playing basketball at the gym, I'm like, hey, I'm headed that way. Sorry, honey. I mean, what was I thinking? So much of my life early on in ministry, I was placing the ministry of that church way above my family. And so because of that, that created a lot of problems for me in my marriage. And I'll never forget walking in front of my college students that I'd spent a year leading, and then one of the elders receiving me and getting up in front of that whole congregation and reading my confession of sin in my life. Life has a way of teaching you lessons that you'll never forget. And then we've all experienced from that moment, I guess last March, when we heard about the pandemic, thinking it was something that was just going to happen over there, but then it comes here. And we probably all thought that we knew the ins and outs of church work and what the church was. And while to certain extents maybe we did, then the pandemic hit, then we realized probably didn't we had a lot we need to learn. But it also provided us, I think, a great opportunity to grow in ways that we probably needed to grow. Life has a way of teaching us lessons. I say all that to say, when Malvin gave me this topic to speak to you guys about effective ministry, maybe like me, you look at your ministry and you see it is filled with a lot of success, but also a lot of failure. You've had moments where you can see that God has used you and God has brought the increase, but you also have experienced disappointments. So what I want to share with you this morning is a collection of things that I've learned. A lot of those I've learned the hard way. And the successes are because God brought about the right people, the right thing at the right time. And what I'm about to share with you too is basically just a list of things that has worked for me and in my family when it comes to ministry. And as I give you this list, this is not an exhaustive list, and probably a lot of you would add some stuff to this. And it's not perfect by any means, but these are just some things that I jotted down. And before I get to this list, I do want to say two things. That when Malvin gave me the topic of effective ministry, the first thing I thought of is effectiveness in ministry is very difficult to gauge, because if you think about it, usually in the past, whenever we're gauging whether or not our ministry is effective, what is it that we usually look at? Numbers. The numbers of people in a classroom, the number of people in an auditorium. And please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. Numbers are important because numbers represent people, people represent souls, and souls matter to God. So numbers are important, but we use that as a picture of what really success is or is not. But one of the things that I think about, as we've been talking about over the past 2 days when it comes to Jesus, whenever Jesus saw a crowd, he actually got really skeptical. In fact, if you remember that time that he took that little boy's, as some people call it, a little Levitical Lunchable or Hebrew Happy Meal, and turned it into a meal for thousands of people. They showed up the next day for another meal. They wanted to consume more. And Jesus sees this massive crowd and he gets skeptical. And so he says, all right, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can have no part of me. At that point, a lot of people are like, yeah, I'm out. And then you fast forward to Luke chapter 14, and one of the hardest texts of the entire Bible, it says this, that there was this great crowd that was accompanying Jesus. And then Jesus says this to the crowd. Unless you hate your own father, your mother, your brother, your sister, even your own self, you can't come after me. And on top of that, you need to take up your cross and you need to follow me. And when they hear cross, they don't think what we think of as like an ornate symbol, a piece of jewelry around your neck. They're thinking Nero, Domitian, Vespasian, all these guys that have cruelly hurt people in some very perverted ways. When they hear cross, they actually think death. So what Jesus was trying to do with that crowd was to get to the heart of why that crowd was really there in the first place. The disciples are probably bewildered, like, wait, we're trying to, you know, sell something here, but you're telling people to take up a cross and to hate their own father, mother, brother, sister, cousin. Yeah, this is not the way, you know, we grow a crowd. This is not why we sell something. He's like, I'm not trying to sell a thing. What I'm actually trying to help people see is that I want to offer a salvation that is more valuable than anything. I just need to know if the crowd recognizes it. And I think the reason why he was skeptical with the crowd is he didn't see the crowd as success, but to him, success was determined by not the number of people in the crowd, but the heart of the people in the crowd. And so when he saw the crowd, he didn't really see a crowd. He actually saw individuals and could see into their heart. The second thing I thought about is not only is effectiveness hard to judge, but when my mind first went into this thought of effectiveness in ministry, I also thought about the idea of efficiency. I know early on in ministry for me, I determined success by the fact that I was efficient. But there's a big difference in effectiveness in ministry and efficiency in ministry. That efficiency focuses on getting a lot of stuff done, getting that list checked off. But effectiveness focuses on doing just a few things really, really well. And so with all of that in mind, I want to give you a few lessons of things that I have learned and things that have worked for me the hard way, some the easier way, but mostly the hard way. And I want to start with you. And if we're going to be effective in ministry, we have to start with us, because you are going to be your greatest leadership challenge. There's a guy named D. Hawk, and you might be familiar with that name. He was the guy that started Visa. And D. Hawk not only started Visa, but one of the things he kind of committed his whole life to was studying leadership and why people lead the way they do and how the results of their leadership styles develop certain results. Well, D. Hawk developed what is called the principle of the compass. And the idea of the compass is, he says, when you think of a leader, the one thing that the leader loves to do is to think of the way he leads like a compass. He leads up. That means he's a visionary. He's somebody like, all right, here's where we are. This is where we want to be. He also leads down, which is the people that are under his care. He also leads laterally, that there's these people that are beside him, different distractions, different stuff that pops up. He leads up, he leads down, he leads laterally. He said the problem with that leadership style alone is he's neglecting the person that's in the middle. And what can happen is that you can offer so much up, down, and side to side that you eventually wear out and get to a point. If you are not squared away where you need to be internally, and you're not squared away where you need to be spiritually, you have nothing to offer your team or anybody else. And so that's why I love David's approach to leadership in 1 Samuel 30. If you remember in 1 Samuel 30, David was, like a lot of us, he was young. He was an emerging leader. He had already experienced a lot of success. He shows back up at the camp, and when he gets to that camp, guess what happened? Some soldiers had come in. They had kidnapped the wives and the children, and they burned a bunch of belongings. And so then on top of that, not only do they have that horrible situation, but then part of the dilemma is that group of people that he was leading, whenever something goes wrong, what are people doing? They're looking up to see who it is they need to blame. And so they're like, all right, well, David, if you would have not done this, or you would have led us better, we wouldn't have been in this position in the first place. They start blaming David, want to get him out of leadership. So what does David do? Well, what would you do if you're in that kind of situation? I know for me, it might be tempting for me to start with the soldiers, all right? Let's meet with the soldiers for just a second, and maybe we can talk them out of being upset and realize this is a big misunderstanding. Or maybe we'll talk with the council, and then we'll get things squared away. David does none of the above. In 1 Samuel 30, verse 6, it says this, that David strengthened himself in the Lord. What David realized is that he could not be what he needed to be for other people until he was where he needed to be spiritually. So I mentioned to you D. Hawk earlier. One of the things that he did in his life is he went around to the most successful businesses and nonprofits, and he wanted to see why those businesses were so successful when it came to leadership. Here's what he found, that those companies that were more successful than all the other companies, the leaders of those companies, the CEOs, had in their life what he called the 50-50 principle. They put 50% of their amperage, as he put it, into self-leadership. And then the other 50% up, down, and laterally. That once they were squared away internally, for us, that would be squared away spiritually. They were able to lead in all the other directions. Y'all might have heard of this book. It's called Emotional Intelligence. And in that book, Gallman, one of the things that he talks about is that he looked at a bunch of young people that got to a position of leadership, and they either did one of two things. They either plateaued really early, or they got burnout really quick. He said the ones that didn't plateau early and the ones that didn't get burnout really quick, you guessed it, they learn the art of self-leadership. Start with you. You're going to be your toughest leadership challenge. Here's the second thing. And again, this has to do with you as well, or your family. And that's Sabbath. Retreat with your wife. Retreat with your kids. God has always been a God of a regular rhythm of rest. You go back to creation after 6 days of work. On the seventh day, he did nothing. You fast forward to Exodus chapter 20. In Exodus chapter 20, it says to keep the Sabbath holy. It was a very set apart day. Well, then we fast forward to the world that we're in now. And what has kind of happened with Sabbath, I think, is number one, it's gotten misunderstood. Because what we've said is, well, you know, there was that time in Matthew when Jesus, you know, was doing work and some people had hate him for doing that. And he said, listen, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. So he's saying, we don't practice Sabbath anymore. Well, when he said in that instance that he was Lord of the Sabbath, he also, by the way, was talking about how he is going to restore the temple. And we talked about that last night, by the way. When he says that, what he was actually referring to more than anything is, I'm deity. Like, I can do what I need to do. Now, you look in Mark chapter 6, he actually says to his disciples, hey, I'm going to go get some rest, some Sabbath. You can come with me, or you don't have to. And so he wasn't eliminating the idea of Sabbath, but what he was actually encouraging us to do is to experience a rest that was even better than Sabbath. And what I mean by that is this, that Sabbath in the Hebrew, or rest in the Hebrew, meant one of two things. It either meant to stop working, or it meant to dwell. And if you think about what Jesus offers, isn't it those two things? To rest, or to stop working, or just dwell. And so while Sabbath is not a command that right now today we are bound to, it is a promise we are invited to, and if we don't take advantage of that opportunity, we are absolutely missing out. Sabbath is golden, and we all have to have it in our lives. And so I think about all of us in our unique positions in ministry, that we spend so much of our life pouring into other people, helping them in their relationships. Some of you in family ministry, helping people in their marriages. You're pouring into other people and preaching funerals, talking about some very hard things. Then you get to Sunday, and for everybody else, what happens on Sunday, it's a day of renewal, relaxation, refreshing. And by the way, whole nother message for another day, it really should be for us too. But I don't think sometimes what we do is prepare enough in the week when we have that time in the office to where we get there on Sunday, we're doing all these last minute things. We haven't trusted our work and then finally get to Sunday and let the Holy Spirit do the work on that day. So that's another message for another day. But one of the things that I think about with us is that we're pouring so much in that Sunday, even for us at times, is not a day of relaxation or renewal or refreshing. And so then we're trying to find ours from somewhere, and then we go home, and you'll probably do what I do on Sunday nights. I call going to my nothing box, and I don't even like care for NFL football that much, but it's on Sunday nights. I'll get on the couch and I go to my nothing box and I watch it. And I've always thought that was rest, that was Sabbath, but reality was I was just distracting myself. Sabbath is not distraction, because Sabbath is true rest. And if you notice Jesus' goal with rest, it was always to encourage people to do two things, to dwell with Him or to experience unity with God. That's not the same thing as a distraction. And I know this is a simple principle, but think for a second about Chick-fil-A. If Chick-fil-A makes four times the profit of KFC, who's open 7 days a week, doesn't that tell you something? That there is value to this rest. And I want to go ahead and tell you that one of the reasons this is so important to me is I feel like it saved my walk with God, and it definitely, definitely blessed my marriage. And here's why. I feel like I was told in a number of ways without really saying it that burnout just affected me as an individual. Do not buy that lie. Burnout does not affect one person. Burnout affects the whole family. And I know that's the case for me. So that's why I want to encourage you. Number one, every single year, the minimum, retreat with just your wife. And you might say, well, I can't afford to. No, you can't afford not to. Then when it comes to your kids, we focus so much and put so much energy in discipling other people's kids. The greatest discipling that we will all do is not in our youth groups, but it's in our home. And so I want to encourage you to make sure you Sabbath in your own way with your wife and your kids. And it's not a time of just distraction, but a time of renewal. And one of the benefits too of Sabbath, by the way, is if you've experienced it to its fullest, it opens up the door for more creativity. More focus, more clarity than probably you've had before. So now let's get into the nuts and bolts of ministry. All right. Effective ministry, it casts vision, it implements that vision, but then it reevaluates that vision. Now, if you'll notice, I didn't just put up here effective ministry cast vision. In the words of Jerry Seinfeld, everybody casts vision. But if you think about it, when it comes to the idea of vision, vision is just a picture in your mind of where you want to be. Vision is that bridge between the present and the future. And one of the things that I've noticed in the churches that I've been in, and probably you've noticed in the churches that you've been in, is everybody casts vision. It's not that we don't cast it. Like, we'll put it on t-shirts, we'll put it on walls, and we'll broadcast it to everybody. And I think what we've done is we're like, hey, I feel better because we casted a vision. Well, anybody can cast vision. And so what happens is we'll cast it, but then we won't get even more specific with the goals, which is the vision broken down into smaller steps, and then got even more specific with the responsibilities of who's actually going to carry out said vision. Now, for you in your own context, it might look a little bit different. But for us at Robert Shell, I feel like we went through a progression. My first few years, we had these themes. I thought they were awesome. We had great graphics. We posted those on walls. We put them on t-shirts, and that's about where it stopped. Because if you're like me, a lot of your vision is something you share at the beginning of the year. The excitement happens for like 2 or 3 months. Then like, now what was that again? That was great that was our vision, but like, what are we actually doing to accomplish that? So we decided to rethink how we do vision. And again, you apply this to your own context of how you want to accomplish this, maybe with your deacons, maybe your, I don't know if you have a youth ministry committee or whatever. So here's what we decided to do. Every November, on the first Saturday of November, we get together and we have a leadership retreat. And what we've done is I basically just typed out all the things as a church God has called us to be and do. We go through number one. We look at number one. This is what God has called us to be as the church in Robertsdale here in Baldwin County. And then we say, what are we doing right now? The next question we ask, in that area, what do we need to do better? Then the next thing we look at, all right, if we need to do so-and-so better, the most important step I think that gets overlooked is this one. Who is going to do it? And so then we put somebody over that area. Then in January, we cast that vision to the greater congregation, let them know where we're going, what our goals are, and how we're going to get there. Well, then what we do is we post that vision in our leadership area where we meet, and then we come back 3 months later and we're like, hey, Andrew, you said you were over this area. How's it going? Jeff, you're over this area. How's that going? Dana, you're over this area. How's it going? And then we can hold each other accountable to see where we're going, see how things are going, and then we reevaluate. Then we come back to the congregation the very middle of the year, and then we say, hey, this is where we are. We haven't done this yet, but this is actually where we're heading, where we're wanting to go. I hope you can kind of see what I'm trying to get at here. It's not just about casting vision. A lot of people can cast vision, but the important part is the implementation, then the reevaluation of that vision. Here's the fourth thing, is to create a what I like to call a made for Mondays mentality. So in Acts chapter 1, verse 8, it says that you will receive the Holy Spirit, and when you receive the Holy Spirit, it says you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the othermost parts of the earth. Now, what's interesting about that is if you look at location-wise, like from a map, he's saying, all right, here's what I want you to do when it comes to witnessing. I want you to first start wherever it is that you are, and then I want you to slowly move your way out. So I want you to start in your town, and then you're going to go from there. And this made for Mondays mentality and connection to witnessing is so important, because the way we've made witnessing now to be today is witnessing, we've made it to be an event. That witnessing is something that you just do occasionally, not a prize and an opportunity that you actually take part in daily. You think about something that Paul said in 1 Corinthians. He says, whatever you do it for the glory of the Lord, whether you eat, you drink, you sleep. He's saying, listen, the prize of life as a Christian are not these things that you just do occasionally, but the prize are things that you do daily. And so to let them see that when they're at school, they're a witness. Witnessing is not just what we do, it's who we are as God's people. When you go to your work, you're a witness. And so this kind of ties into the way we teach, to let them see their school, their work, through the lens of being a witness. And what's neat about that is that schools or places of work are oftentimes those places that are just extremely, in our minds, dark. But I also think that those are the places that he intends to make us actually more like Jesus Christ. And so instead of encouraging our kids, just, hey, listen, grin and bear it through the day at school. I know you don't agree with stuff. Just, you know, keep your mouth shut and you be sweet, Sally. No, Sally, you be a witness. It says, because when you receive the Holy Spirit, you will be, you are a witness in that place in your unique context to create a made for Monday mentality. Here's the next thing, to create a culture of prayer. So one of the things that I've done at Robertsdale, and I'm not ashamed to do it, is I look around at what are the churches that are growing. And I will call them and say, hey, what are you doing that we need to learn from so we can adopt that? So there's two churches in particular that they probably, their secretary knows me and she's probably sick of me calling. But anyway, I'll call them, all right, so what do y'all think about this? I was thinking about doing this. Have y'all done this or tried this before? Well, these two churches that I call on a regular basis to get their ideas on stuff and to see what is helping them grow. And again, remember how we talked about growth. That it's not just the way, just numbers, right? That we look at growth through the lens of, are we loving God and loving other people? And so anyway, those two churches that I call, I thought was really interesting that both of them said that the way that they feel like they've grown the most is both of them said, top of the list, at our congregations, we have created a culture of prayer. And so you go back to the Church of Acts, and one of the things that you'll notice when you look in Scripture is that prayer was the catalyst for their growth. It's like even when they were told, listen, you can't talk about Jesus, they're like, oh man, that stinks. Let's go pray about that. And then they got even more bold. And so what was something for them that was just foundational, what's happened, I think, fast forward thousands of years to where we're at today, it's become supplementary for us. And so how can you change a culture of prayer? Well, since we are all leaders in our own unique context as in churches, I want to tell you, to create a better culture of prayer, it starts at the top with you. And so the first thing that needs to change if we're going to develop a culture of prayer is the way we see prayer. One of the things as you go throughout Scripture, and this is outside of those instances where Paul writes a letter at the very beginning of the letter, he's like, hey guys, I wish I could be there in person, but I've been praying for you and I thank God for you. Outside of those occasions, you never see in Scripture Peter walks up to John and says, John, hey man, how's your mom doing? Oh, she's not doing well. Oh man, I'm going to pray for her. See you later, man. Like, that never happens. That if somebody needed prayer, what did they do? They stopped and they prayed. And so that's what I'm getting at. If we want to change a culture and make a culture of prayer, it starts with us. But not only do we need to change the leader, but we also need to change what I'll call the list, and we also need to change the location. And when I mean list, if you're like me when it comes to your prayer life, you kind of get caught in a little bit of a rut. You kind of pray the same thing. And then you kind of, if you're not careful too, you get in that little box where it's just rinse and repeat every time. So again, just throwing out different ideas, and again, got this one from another congregation too, that right before the pandemic, we started something at Robertsdale that to me was one of the greatest blessings, and we actually used it as an opportunity for evangelism too, and we called it Gather. Basically what we did on the first Sunday of every month, about an hour and a half before worship, we had a room at our church building that we try to make it kind of a neat vibe and feel. And we had a whiteboard. And on that whiteboard, we had a pie chart. And the pie chart was broken down into different sections. One of those was a section for us. And we circled up all the chairs to pray for what's going on in each person's life individually. And then there was another piece of that pie chart that focused on the church. What is it that we need to be praying for about what we need to do as a church? Then we added another piece to that pie chart. What are some things that are going on in our community that we need to pray for? Then we got bigger to the world. But then one of the coolest parts of that pie chart was a section that we created for praise, like great things that are happening in the life of other people. And what's been neat is that time, you know, we're finding out what's going on about each other, not because we're trying to get in all in each other's business, but now because we know John's struggling with this, or hey, so-and-so just got a promotion, and you know, we know what to celebrate about, but we know if someone's going through something hard, we can mourn with them. And you hear the Bible when Jesus says, you know, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. That takes two people. And in order for that to happen, you have to have an atmosphere to where people are engaged with each other through prayer and by understanding what maybe people might be going through. Create a culture of prayer. I'm going to kind of get through this quick because I'm running out of time. Effective ministry also invests in professional development. I don't want to spend too much time on this one. There's a lot of really good stuff out there, i.e. what you're doing right now. And lectureships are great and all. But part of the issue with lectureships, in what I've experienced, we also need some of the more practical nuts and bolts things. They're out there. And if you want a list of some of those, I can give you some of those that have been a huge encouragement to me. Here's the next one I want to spend a little bit more time on. Implement in your ministry inclusive gospel-centered teaching. Emphasis on that word right there, inclusive and gospel-centered. Most of the ways that we teach today is through lecture. Nothing wrong with lecture. I'm lecturing right now, obviously. But what's interesting is they've done studies on how people learn. And most learners are kinesthetic, which is hands-on learning, or visual, through things that they see. Both of those either have to do with see or touch. The lowest amount of people, of learners, are actually audible learners. Well, what's the most common way we teach? Audible. But most learners are kinesthetic or they're visual. And so in my dissertation, one of the topics or directions I decided to go was to focus on the style and the way that we teach. And so what was interesting is I would have never known this, but there was actually a lot of studies that were done of churches. This is just evangelical churches, not churches of Christ, but how people teach in those settings. And one of the things that they've noticed is that overwhelmingly within evangelical churches, the way that we teach is through what is called pedagogy. You probably remember that as a kid learning about that. Pedagogy is the art and science of how children learn. Pedagogy is focused on lecture-oriented teaching. Well, then did a study to figure out, all right, well, what are we doing in the church? All right, overwhelming were pedagogy and pedagogy alone. Well, then end up finding out after polling people in churches of Christ, guess what they're wanting? Something called andragogy, which is the art and science of, yes, adult learning, but keeping the student at the center of the learning experience. Ways to make whatever it is that they've learned can apply to Monday. Whatever it is that they are learning, that they can put it in their life tomorrow, but also to get them engaged through discussion, through seeing what it is that they're learning. And so one of the things I encourage you to do is to look into that, to think of ways that you can break up the rhythm of how you speak and maybe try different things, use different methods, whatever that might be. The final thing is this, effective ministry develops a culture of contribution, not consumption. In John 4, right after Jesus had met the woman at Jacob's well, I guess the disciples just thought that Jesus was hungry. I don't know if they offered him like carrots and hummus or what, but they said to him, Rabbi, teacher, eat something. And then he makes this statement. He says, well, my food is actually to do the will of the one who sent me. And just through that statement alone, he's saying, listen, when everybody else is thinking about provide for me, give me, I'm thinking about pour into everybody else. And so what's happened is, and I was thinking about this with you guys being in youth ministry, your kids in your youth group were raised by parents that went church shopping, looking for a church that meets what? You've heard this, their needs, right? They were raised with this mentality that church is not about being a spiritual contributor, but only being a spiritual consumer. What can you give me? What can you provide for me? So how do you break that culture? Well, if you look at Jesus's ministry, when there was a mindset of consumption, he loved to hone in on two areas. Wash feet, break bread. wash feet, break bread. Wash feet, break bread. He called his disciples to go up into this upper room, which was supposed to be like one of the most intimate, special moments where he's going to let them know, hey, listen, I'm leaving this earth, but hey, this is actually a good thing. And he walks up the steps to that upper room, and I don't know if he's rehearsing his speech of what he's going to say, but he walks in, opens that door, and he sees his disciples acting like a bunch of two-year-olds. They're having this conversation about which one of them is going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So what is his impulse? He takes a robe, gets down on all fours, and one after another washes their feet. By the way, one of those sets of feet was Judas's. He washes their feet. And I've always tried to like put this into terms of like, what would this be like today? This is like Mother Teresa coming to your house and cleaning your toilets, okay? Jesus gets down on all fours and does the nastiest job, and one after another begins to wash his disciples' feet. Well, how do we wash feet? Well, I think for us in our ministries, especially in youth ministry, but in all aspects, if we can create a culture of foot washing in our ministries, that's really going to be one of those lines. We said effective ministry is loving God, loving other people. It's not just about numbers. And so if we're going to love God and love other people through washing feet, how can we do that? Well, one of my favorite Bible verses is Jeremiah 29:7. And it says this. It says that I have sent you like exiles into your cities where I have planted you to pursue peace and prosperity. That God has planted every single one of you in your city where you are to be a conduit of peace and prosperity. So we have to be in touch then with what are the needs in my city. So, and I'm going to try to get through this quickly. There's a study done in the Bible Belt about what people are wanting and thinking about and needing in their communities. Here are the top four things that people said that they think about. These are people outside of your church that they think about. Number one, safety. Number two, hunger. Number three, intergenerational success. And number four, where's my list? Addiction, recovery, and rehab. Those are the four things that they're thinking about. Well, if you think about those four things that people in our communities and cities are wanting, guess what we as kingdom people have to offer? Safety. We have the answer for that. What about hunger? You know, I heard a stat recently that said that every week, 100,000 children die from preventable starvation. But in the public schools, I know this is in Alabama, every county at least offers the opportunity for what is called a backpack food program. Some of y'all might be in that. You know about what that is. If you don't, call your schools. And what you can do is, and if you have a pantry, you could utilize that. When the kids go to recess, those kids that the teacher notices that like when they sit down to eat a meal, that they're scarfing it down because they haven't had a meal the night before. That what she does when they're gone to recess, the churches that are partnering with them through that backpack school food program, they put food enough for that meal for that night in that kid's backpack and zip it up so they're not embarrassed. And then they go home and mom and dad can pull that meal out and cook it for them that night. Again, the creativity is in all of you guys. I'm just letting you know there are a lot of things out there. The other thing, intergenerational success. Again, we as the church have the opportunity to offer that addiction, recovery, and rehab. Maybe we're not really there yet. We need to be, but maybe we're not really there yet. To create a culture of contribution, not consumption. In the next session, we're going to get to some things that we might have learned from the pandemic and ways that we can leverage the things that we did learn to further our ministries and to impact those that are around us. So thank you, guys.